The following portion of the Frank Wucco Show is live role play meant for entertainment and educational purposes only. Please do not contact the authorities.
Now, coming as close as you'd ever want to a terrorist sworn to destroy your way of life, it's Ask the Jihadist.
Oh, yes. Ask the Jihadist, everybody. Woo! It's Friday, November 3rd, 2017. Welcome to Raging Chicken's Out the Coop podcast. This is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. Each week, I talk to our Capitol muckraker in chief, Sean Kitchen, about the good, the bad, and the ugly in state and national politics. The numbers are in. We hit record levels of CO2 in the atmosphere this year. 403.3 parts per million, up from 400 parts per million in 2015. What's that mean? Well, let's start with hundreds of millions of people displaced from coastal cities, longer droughts, and fiercer hurricanes. Good thing that the Trump administration brought on Michael Honeycutt to lead the EPA's Science Advisory Board. At least now we'll have the Bible to guide our environmental policy. And just in case Honeycutt can't get the job done, Representative Jim Bridenstine, a climate denier, is on his way to become the next NASA chief. That'll work. Meanwhile, Mother Jones has reported that Homeland Security hired Frank Wucco, a guy who used to LARP as a jihadist named Fuad Wasul, to lead the department's executive order task force. That was the task force that was created to make sure that Trump's executive orders against Muslims get carried out. Another billionaire destroys media outlets because workers vote to unionize. Rip Gothamist and DNA Info. Donna Brazile tosses a grenade into the Democratic Party. And one of the first Democratic Party postmortem drops and rips the party a new one. Angela Columbus, a reporter for the Philly Inquirer and the Post-Gazette, talks about what it's like working in Harrisburg as a woman reporter. Dickinson College student dresses up as Colin Kaepernick in blackface. Penn Live initially reported the student was dressed as a black person before recognizing the Kaepernick's jersey, not to mention the other guy pointing a gun at his head. We go to an extended members-only segment on this one, folks. Our first one ever. Woo! Philadelphia Mayor Jim Kenney announces the city will seize control of Philadelphia's public schools from the School Reform Commission. That's potentially one giant stiff arm to the forces of privatization. And next Friday kicks off the March on Harrisburg 2.0. This time, marchers will be walking the 36 miles from Lancaster to Harrisburg to support for their bills to end gerrymandering, ban unlimited gifts to state legislators, and create automatic voter registration. In today's last call, Pizza Boy is releasing a New England IPA called Doughboy on Monday. And watch out, the juice is loose! Pizza Boys released the White Bronco on Wednesday. Think about that for a second, folks. Just give it a second to sink in. Free Will's had a big week, releasing Love Letter from the 90s and Special Cookie this week. And they're entering into November, in the best way possible, with a great line of food trucks out this weekend. And is Sean a closet vapophobe? We'll get into that one in Let's Call. Stop the vaping, man! Tune into the Rick Smith Show on Free Speech TV this week and every Saturday at 7 p.m. Eastern. I'm not on this week. Rick recorded down at the AFL-CIO convention this past week. You can stream the show live at freespeech.org, and you can also tune in the Dish Network, DirecTV, or through the Free Speech TV app on Roku. And if you missed the show, just go to ricksmithshow.com and click on the Free Speech TV icon on the sidebar. And then huge announcement this week. I don't know if you caught our Facebook Live, but we reached our first membership goal. Woo! This is huge, folks. Special shout out to Melissa, to Astrid, to Randall, and Steve for becoming members this week and putting us over the top. Right, I mean, four members in a week. These folks kind of showed up, and man, thank you so much. I mean, putting us over the top. What that means is that, in addition to our kind of like monthly stipend that we're able to kind of, get, you know, very minimal, as I'm sure Sean will tell you, minimal stipend that we're able to kind of give its writers. This will actually kind of add pay writers for additional articles that they contribute to the show each month. So huge. Thank you so much for becoming a member, all y'all. And if you like what you hear, and if you too want to support Pull No Punches Progressive Media, be like Melissa, Astrid, Randall, and Steve and become a member of Raging Chicken for as little as $5 a month. Simply go to the RagingChickenPress.org and look for the Support and Membership tab. Click Become a Member and you're on your way. If you're not ready to become a member, no problem. You can still make a one-time donation by clicking Donate. Remember, a member a day keeps the fascists away, folks. That's what we're talking about. Huge week, Sean. Man, an amazing week. Amazing week. We hit our membership goal.
Yeah, and also, on top of hitting our membership goal, we are now having our best year on record with the Raging Chicken Press since we started 6 years ago, which is also pretty awesome.
Yeah, it is. That,
you know, I think like back in 2013, we had 169,000 hits on the website. We're now at 175. We want to hit 200,000, which, you know, doesn't seem like a lot for, you know, the big media sites out there. But for us, you know, that is a lot concerning. It's, you know, a handful of us doing this in Pennsylvania. And, you know, we have, you know, expanded our readership a lot this year, you know, by, especially through covering what's been going on since Charlottesville and, you know, the stuff happening right here in our backyard with the alt-right. And, you know, how they're trying to organize and stuff like that. You know, it's something we've been decided to put actual resources to and covering and bringing and, you know, name and shame these people.
No, that's exactly it. And, you know, you make the perfect point. We've talked about this like from the get-go is that, you know, when you make a commitment to this kind of doing this kind of media work, right, which is not, we've never set out to kind of be like the next national media site, right? We kind of always believed in kind of digging deep right here in Pennsylvania in our own backyard and kind of building out a progressive media network right here in Pennsylvania, right? And that's where our commitment lies. And, you know, on the one hand, you know, you look at we're closing in on 200,000 hits on the year. That's freaking huge. We're approaching a kind of 1 million overall, right? That is, you know, just blows my mind. We've got to go to look at that. But most importantly, you look at kind of some of the impact of our reporting. We talked a little about this last week, but, you know, it matters to me. Things like, you know, the report that I did about the adjunct faculty member who was kicked to the curb when they found out that they needed life-saving surgery. University fires this person and then they lose their health care and all that kind of stuff. Raging Chicken was not only did we break that story, right, and did we kind of shine a light on that and kind of get attention paid, but we took part in kind of raising money for that individual and raised kind of about $6,000 to ensure that their Cobra Cross were covered. And now there's been success. They've had successful surgery and now they're going to be able to recover without having to worry over the next, you know, where they're, you know, how they're going to meet their bills or are they going to go into substantial amounts of debt, things like that. Or the stories that you start, Sean, that, you know, that you've been kind of covering consistently. And this is the other part of it. Only when you're, you know, you're doing this work on a consistent basis, covering things like the what's going on in this state with the alt-right and so on, can you track some of these people and see these developments? And our reach has been way bigger than just on our site. I mean, we get picked up, and your reporting has gotten picked up by numerous outlets like Huffington Post, like The Intercept and so on, that as part of that puzzle of kind of putting that national picture. And I think, you know, that's the kind of approach that we need.
No, one of the things, and exactly, like one of the things I, you know, it's kind of hard to describe ourselves to people, but, you know, I try to, like, explain that we model ourselves off of sort of like the type of work that The Intercept is doing or Mother Jones is doing, but on a Pennsylvania, we're focused on what's solely happening right here in our own state. So, I mean, that's the type of reporting we strive out to do. I'm sure we're going to have blogs every once in a while. It's just a little clicky, but, you know, most of the stuff we're not doing is trying not to clickbait for thousands of hits, you know. We're trying to actually put actual thoughtful reporting out there, and, you know, something we've been doing over the past few months, over the past year, and especially since Charlottesville happened.
Yeah, you know, it's and that's a difficult. You meant to kind of, you know, that we don't kind of put out a lot of clickbaity stuff, right? Like you see in these other sites, is because, you know, one of the challenges for doing this kind of work is actually how you kind of make it happen, right? Like, how do you make it happen financially? How do you make it happen, like, by pay the bills, the server sites, and all that other kinds of stuff? And, you know, one of the models is that, you know, you put a whole bunch of listy stuff and clickbaity stuff and all this kind of stuff to try to drive kind of, you know, the advertising dollars and so on. We've chosen not to do that. You know, we said, yeah, sure, we've got a couple ads on our site and things like this, but they're really not where we've put our energies. And our energies are consistently coming back to, we're trying to kind of build that membership base because we want people in the progressive community to actually be the ones who we answer to, right? I mean, is that if you step up and you become a member of Raging Chicken Press, then we know, you know, our community is coming out and supporting us so that we can do this work and help to build the community back, right? It's that kind of reciprocal relationship. It's a lesson that the right wing learned a long, long time ago about how to do. And I think that, you know, we're starting to kind of, you know, make those inroads. So, you know, we're actually, not only do we meet our first goal, but we're on our way to our second goal now, which again, then we can even increase the stipends for writers each week. So, you know, that's what it's all about, folks, is we're all in this together, going to support these efforts. You know, so I appreciate those folks who are doing this.
And it looks like one of the things we'll focus on later on in our members-only podcast, first members-only segment, is the reciprocity within the right-wing movement and how a couple of how this guy tried to troll me on Twitter and go after my reporting because I shot off a mistweet. But, you know, by digging into this website, you'll see this reciprocity within the right by just looking at their bios and where these people have come from and where they're going. It's a revolving door within the right, training their writers and bringing them onto national outlets.
Exactly. So if you're a member, make sure you do that. You'll be able to kind of get access to that through the Patreon site. We do have some other members too as well. Now, if you look at our Patreon site, you notice, I think it's like, you know, there's 11 members, something like that. We used to have our membership program that was going through Podbean. So we have some members that are through there too as well. We'll make sure that, you know, you're going to have access to that too as well, even though if you're not a member through Patreon, if you've joined through the Podbean fundraising platform, we'll make sure that you get links to that so you can have access to it. So, you know, it's a big deal. So, you know, thanks to everybody. So anyways, on to the news. So for, you know, one of the things this week has been a huge week for, you know, climate change, you know, looking at what's going on in climate change, both in terms of the actual scientific data that we're seeing, as well as what this Trump administration is doing, and how it's positioning our response to this.
Yeah, I know this is something that's been happening. Something we haven't really touched a lot upon, what's been happening with Trump administration, climate change, and what's been happening, especially at the EPA. You know, we were talking before this, but the stuff that's happening on at the EPA is, you know, once the Trump administration's gone, this is going to be the long-lasting effects on our government and on our environment, to be clear. I mean, you know, pulling out of the climate agreement in Paris, pulling out of, you know, stop publishing, you know, or stop funding or giving critical attention to institutions that report on climate change or that gather data for climate change, you know, within the EPA or within NOAA or the National Weather Service. You know, and I guess we have a couple of big stories this week surrounding that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if you look at, you know, this is some great reporting in The Guardian and other places too as well. But so basically, the UN is warning that you need drastic action now if they're going to even come anywhere close to hitting the Paris Accords. And they said the concentration of carbon dioxide, this is from The Guardian, Jonathan Watts, the concentration of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere increased at a record speed last year to hit a level not seen for more than 3 million years, the UN has warned. And it says the report has raised alarm among scientists and prompted calls for nations to consider more drastic emissions reductions in the coming climate negotiations in Bonn. You know, and this is actually, you know, we can get all lost in the science and everything like this, but, you know, this is what I mean by that is, like, you know, we could talk about parts per billion and all that kind of stuff. And that stuff is critical. So definitely check out the links here, but what it translates into, right? The 403.3 parts per million of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, it looks like it's locking in, locking in a 3 degree Celsius rise in global temperatures, which basically means that you're going to have literally hundreds of billions of people that will be displaced from coastal cities. Things like, you know, so some of the pictures on the Guardian site, for example, where they're kind of showing the estimates where, you know, Miami Beach, for example, is pretty much going to be underwater. A third of the state of Florida will be underwater. The city of Alexandria in Egypt will be virtually be underwater, displacing about 100 million people. Or 8 million.
Boston.
Yep.
You know, possibly parts of Philadelphia.
New York City.
New York. You know, you have, people think Philadelphia is going to be safe from this. But, you know, parts of South Philadelphia and the river wards will be completely underwater as sea levels rise. Because I think the Delaware River can reach a maximum of like 2.5 to 3 miles in width at this point. You know, you think Philadelphia is far enough inland. But, you know, the sea level rise is going to go through the bay and into the rivers. And even cities that are inland along these rivers are going to be suffering it. There's maps out there showing that. We saw this past fall with happened to Puerto Rico and islands getting virtually wiped off the map at this point, you know, because of strong Category 4 or 5 hurricanes. You know, this stuff's going to become the norm. This isn't going to, like, this is what we're talking about, displacement. It could happen in a blink of an eye with a hurricane just completely destroying a region.
Yep.
Or it can happen over a course of a century. You know, it's... Either way, it's going to happen.
Yeah, you know, and I think that that's what people don't understand entirely is that, you know, you're talking about, if you look at some of the estimates, you're saying anywhere from a couple decades to like the end of the century. And the reason why is exactly the reason why there's such kind of those big differences is exactly what you said, is because scientists are unsure about are we going to see these big catastrophic leaps. And some of the models show that basically you hit a certain tipping point and then there's like a cascade and then you kind of start to increase. Then there's a cascade and those cascades are devastating, right? I mean, that's when you're talking about huge chunks of the Antarctic ice shelves falling into the sea, right? And kind of like dramatically raising sea levels.
Yeah, they're negative feedback loops.
Exactly.
Or the permafrost, the thawing of the permafrost, which is going to release methane gas. And methane is like 10 or 15, 20 times worse than CO2 in the atmosphere when it comes out to like the reflectivity of the sun, you know, or trapping the sun's heat inside the earth. You know, it makes the greenhouse gases that much worse. And, you know, methane will then it's in the atmosphere for 20 years and then the methane bonds will break apart and it'll form CO2. So then it'll be in the atmosphere for another 200 years on top of that.
Yep.
You know. You know, these are the negative feedback loops that we're looking at. And good thing we have the Book of Joshua.
Yeah, well, you know, I was
this.
Exactly. I was getting worried about that. But then I realized that, oh, no.
The Bible is going to.
Yeah. The Trump's got this. The Trump administration is putting everybody who we need in place.
So there's another crazy story this week happening about the EPA, you know, the gutting of our environmental protections and having, you know, a bunch of grifters running this organization, this outlet now. You know, Charlie Pierce had a good excerpt from a BuzzFeed report about Honeycutt and a couple of other people getting appointed to these advisory boards. And Pruitt, this is how it starts. Pruitt used a story from the Book of Joshua to help explain the new policy. On the journey to the Promised Land, Joshua says, "The people of Israel, to the people of Israel, choose this day whom you are going to serve." Pruitt said, "This is sort of like the Joshua principle. That is, as it relates to grants from this agency, you are going to have to choose either service on the committee to provide counsel to us in an independent fashion or choose the grant, but you can't do both. That's the fair and great thing to do."
Well, there you have it. I feel good.
So we're basically going after people, scientists, EPA scientists conducting independent research. And one of the people that he appointed to the place this week is called this guy named Michael Honeycutt. A Texas Observer says this, for years, Texas's chief toxicologist, Michael Honeycutt has accused the EPA of scaring the public about the health risks of toxic chemicals. The EPA, he said, ignores good science, which demonstrates that a chemical is not as toxic as they think it is, uses Chicken Little toxicity values, and doesn't do the common sense ground truthing. Mercury? EPA is overstating the risks of exposure and ignoring the fact that the Japanese eat 10 times as much fish as Americans. My You're God. Shaking your head about this.
I just
arsenic. It could be unsafe because we're. It couldn't be unsafe because we're not seeing increases in cancer rates. That would be true if the EPA assessments is realistic. Ozone. EPA's ozone rules are unnecessary because Americans likely spend at least 90% of their time indoors.
Look, this is seriously the kind of stuff that people come up with just by making shit up. They're sitting around, they're drinking beer, and they're like, "They can't be fucked. They can't look. What you see? This mercury can't hurt you, man. If it hurts you, we all be dead by now." Yeah, totally, man. These scientists know what they're talking about. That's literally like what this stuff sounds like to me.
It's okay. So I actually had two people at the bar once. This is like back in the wintertime last winter, debating if the Earth was round or flat. And the person who
we're all gonna die.
The person stating that the Earth was flat was winning the argument and winning his friend over to believing that point. I'm just like, I can't look at those people the same anymore.
What, I mean,
this.
I don't even know what to do with that. I don't even know what to do with that. You know, I mean, I can't. And again, this is I don't even want to get into all the kind of potential explanations about why this is. I just don't get that. And it disturbs the living hell out of me that those conversations actually happen, right? And people take that seriously.
But this is the modern – this is the thinking that the modern GOP has created.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right.
And these
right.
are the people we're putting in charge. I mean, like, I guess you have a good thing about NASA this week.
Well, here, okay, so here, so yeah, so not only, so you want to talk about, this is why this is so concerning. You remember one of the first things that the Trump administration did when they took office, right? Right after the inauguration was to basically pull down all the pages on climate change from the website. And then they put like a gag order basically on the EPA from using the words climate change and stuff that they're, and materials that they were putting out to the public. And then they started doing this review of this and basically putting out the word that they were going to, you know, if anybody was going to talk about climate change and this kind of data, they could potentially lose their jobs. That's one of the things that launched the whole kind of like, you know, the alt EPA and like, you know, the secret EPA Twitter accounts and all this kind of stuff that was part of a kind of a resistance to that move. Right. So this has been going on now, but now we're getting these people in place. So NASA. Right. And this actually originally started with saying, oh, we should talk about this in the space news. But like, this is not space news. This is freaking our lives right now. Is that NASA, of course, is one of the key agencies with that monitors global temperatures. Right. NASA's one
they have two big satellites up there. You know, they're responsible for putting the satellites in space from, you know, and collecting the data. So like one of the things, you know, I took a class in college based on remote sensing. And I actually wrote papers on how NASA creates technology to read the spectral reflection right. curves of carbon dioxide, methane, and other prominent greenhouse gases. So, like this, they're actually a pretty big player in the monitoring of climate change when it comes towards putting satellites and putting the instruments in space to read what's happening within our atmosphere.
Exactly. I mean, they're considered not just for the United States, like globally,
the world,
because they have some of the most comprehensive data and kind of available because of the instrumentation that they have there. And this is also one of the key charges of what NASA has set out to do, right? I mean, we talk about NASA's role in space exploration and all that kind of stuff. Obviously, that's the kind of, you know, stuff that a lot of people just will associate with NASA right away. But one of the aspects of it is the atmospheric and kind of like Earth studies, right? Earth science is one in the mission statement of what NASA is supposed to do. There's that. So you have that. So you got the EPA who's attempting to kind of, you know, environmental regulations on the one hand. Now you've got kind of the organization that is being, you know, is one of the key organizations that's basically looking accumulating science, climate science. I'm sorry, I'm getting way ahead of myself here. Sorry about that, everybody. I'm frustrated by this. And now the Trump administration is basically looking to put a climate denier there too as well, right? So now you've got this guy, he's Representative Bridenstine, right, who's basically being brought in to run NASA. All right, so I want to give you a little bit of a clip. This is from, I believe it's 2013, when Jim Bridenstine, he's from Oklahoma. He's a Republican, of course, from Oklahoma. This is when he went before Congress to talk about climate change and ask Obama to apologize for spending so much money and time investing in climate science. So this is how he begins his little chat.
Mr. Speaker, global temperatures stopped rising 10 years ago. Global temperature changes, when they exist, correlate with sun output and ocean cycles. During the medieval warm period from 800 to 1300 AD, long before cars, power plants, or the Industrial Revolution, temperatures were warmer than today. During the Little Ice Age from 1300 to 1900 AD, temperatures were cooler. Neither of these periods were caused by any human activity.
You see what this is? This is just like stating things to kind of make him sound like he's actually done his research and he hasn't done squat, right? Why don't you just say, like, you know, in the early days when the Earth was first forming, temperatures were a lot more, like, hotter because the whole planet was molten, right? I mean, why not say that? I mean, he's just saying these random things without any kind of explanation, without any background, and as if they add up to an argument. But they mimic an argument, so it makes it look like this. So this is so now he goes to he's in the Senate hearing, right? And you have some of these kind of senators and some of these representatives who are basically calling him to task on this. So I want to just play a little bit of a clip of what this hearing looked like this week. This is from Senator Brian Schatz. He's a Democrat from Hawaii, right? He was asking Bridenstine about his positions on climate change. So this is a little bit of the dance, okay? So here is we start off with Brian Schatz.
Said, is that this is a science agency. And I get that you don't have a scientific background, and I don't begrudge you that, although it is true that previous administrators had extraordinary scientific backgrounds. But I don't begrudge you that because I don't have a scientific background. But you know what I do is I defer to scientists. I rely on the scientific consensus. And the scientific consensus is not that it's really difficult to tell how much of climate change is attributable to human activity. The scientific consensus is that climate change is primarily caused by human activity. Do you agree with the scientific consensus?
If that's the scientific consensus, that it's primarily driven by human activity, what I will tell you is that
you don't know that that's the scientific consensus?
Sir, I would say human activity absolutely is a contributor to the climate change that we are currently seeing.
What is the scientific consensus about climate change?
I think right now we're just scratching the surface as to the entire system of the Earth. And one of the great missions of NASA is the Earth Science Division of the Science Mission Directorate. And
yeah, see, this is what he do. He starts dancing around. We're only scratching the surface on it. Because, you know, Sean, there are other theories out there about what's going on with the planet. For example,
the Earth moves closer to the sun every year. We have more people. You know, humans have warm bodies. So is heat coming off? We're just going through a lot of change, but I think we are, as a society, doing the best we can.
The Earth is, like, as fabulous and as mysterious as you possibly can.
And that's your next governor, people.
That's your next governor, right?
I'm doing the best I can.
That's basically what this guy is saying. Hey.
I'm doing the best I can.
Right? And he will not come out and say this. And earlier in that same hearing, Schatz comes out and basically says, okay, look, here's what you're going to do. Right. You're going to say that you agree that there's some contributing, but then you're going to say it gets all mucky. You can't say how much and we don't really know. Right. And he basically calls out and lays out what the Republican, what this ultra right wing climate denying faction is basically doing and basically how they kind of construct their argument to pull one over on the American people. And, you know, and then what does he do? He just goes ahead and he does it. Does exactly what Schatz says that he's going to do. And so this is the guy that's going to be at the head of NASA, right? And, you know, and remember, Ted Cruz, he's one of the kind of the heads of the, you know, on the space committee that looks over NASA and things like this. I was like, he has been after NASA for several years now, right, to basically saying NASA needs to get back to its mission, right, because most people think of NASA solely in terms of its space exploration, right, and they don't know that it has a charge to do Earth science. So Ted Cruz basically said, you need to do more space exploration. You know, you need to get back to what you're supposed to be doing in here and stop worrying about all this Earth science stuff. And so that is why that we see the UN putting out these dire warnings right now, because they see the writing on the wall. You got the U.S. pulling out of the Paris Agreement, right? And now you see these kind of people being putting in significant positions. And so the world knows that the U.S. is out of the game. right? The U.S. is out of the game, despite what Jerry Brown and California is doing, despite what they're doing in New York and so on, to try to kind of roll back this roll back emissions. It's going to be too little, too late.
You know, it's like I grew up listening to Bad Religion.
Yeah,
like one of my favorite like punk bands growing up listening to, and it wasn't like the new Bad Religion stuff. I'm talking about like I grew up listening to Bad Religion back in like the mid '80s to early '90s. And it feels like they're starting to become like prophets.
How about that?
About the stuff that they like were singing back like 30 years ago. You know, it just doesn't seem like disgruntled punk rockers, but now they seem like actual prophets on this shit.
Yeah, well,
this is exactly what they sung about 30 years ago.
Yes, it is.
Flat Earth Society, like all that type of stuff. American Jesus, like all that. Yep, this is it right here coming to fruition.
Welcome to the wonderful world of insanity. Oh my God! And speaking of insanity, so this is on the climate side. Then the other thing, Mother Jones. I don't mean to shift gears too much, but this is just crazy. Mother Jones broke the story this week that so there's this guy, the head of I shouldn't say he's the head of, because he's not the head of. He works in the Homeland Security. His name is Frank Wuko, right? And he's a military guy, and he started this kind of private firm, and he'd do this consulting work where he would try to consult with, you know, military personnel about how to understand jihad. And what he did is that he basically constructed this entire character, right? Alter ego, Fuad Wasul, right? And he would put the dress on and everything like this, wear the hat. He put on a horrible fake Arab accent, right? And then would basically like pretend to be a jihadist.
That type of, it's like South Park type stuff.
And, you know, seriously. I mean, this guy, I mean, I don't even know what to do with this stuff.
He's a LARP.
Well, that's exactly it. It's like live action role play, folks. You know, here it is right now. You know, that's a shout out to, Old Man and Skinny Guy down there doing the gaming podcast. And they talk also about LARPing. They should hook up with this guy and they can make themselves and, you know, get themselves a direct line to the White House. I mean, this is the guy that's been put in charge of making sure that Trump's executive orders get carried out. And you heard a little bit of that like up front, but I just have to give you just a little bit more of this piece. So I you heard a bit of it. Just I want to give you a little taste of the kind of stuff that this guy does.
The following portion of the Frank Wuko Show is live role play meant for entertainment and educational purposes only.
It's his radio show.
Please do not contact the authorities.
Now, coming as close as you'd ever want to a terrorist sworn to destroy your way of life, it's Ask the Jihadist. Here's your jihadist, Fuad Wasul.
And good day. My name is Fuad Wasul. I am brought for you by the Frank Wuko Show to make clear to the listeners of the show that they're the correct path and understanding for jihad.
Totally not jihad, racist, though.
Jihad.
Exactly.
Is, right? The correct way to make sure that the earth and
can
the human is correct to prepare the earth for the final judgment of Allah.
I mean, it goes on and on like this. That's his radio show, right? So this was actually going out. This is like it aired on like iHeartRadio. I don't know. And used to broadcast on... what was it? It was Florida radio, I guess. That's the best I can tell. WFLA 970. So this was actually a radio show. He had his regular radio show, and then there'd be this break, and then they put out the warning, right, that don't call the police. It's not a real jihadist. And they bring him on, and he does his, like, you know, his LARP right on air. And this is kind of what he's basically was doing as part of Homeland Security, too, as well. This is nuts, man.
I like, so one of the reasons why I love doing the media stuff is like getting shit like this. Like, I mean, like, imagine just you're the journalist and you get this tip.
Yeah.
Like, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, you're laughing at that point. You're like, you're just laughing because it's gallows humor. You're just like, are you serious? I can't believe this is happening.
No, exactly, right? And this is actually – Mother Jones got this information through a right-to-know request too as well. I mean, they wanted to kind of see like where this guy was. And, you know, he's been working in Homeland Security back since February, and April is when he was appointed to this task force to ensure that Trump's executive orders have been carried out, right? And this guy is, you know – And if you listen to, he's got some videos out and things like this that you can click down in the show notes if you really want to check it out. You can look at some of the videos, the kind of the promo materials that he would send out, you know, basically as part of his consulting stuff about, you know, I will take you through an experience that you will know what it's like to feel jihad. You know, I mean, it's like, it's insane. Crazy. And you, if you act now, you get a cake too. You know, it's like, you know, it's like, this is this guy. I can't believe it.
Allahu Akbar.
Exactly. I mean, it's just like, you know, what do you do with these people? What do you do with these people? That's all you can do, man.
Illogical.
But crazy. So, all right. So, Sean, I want to talk about this briefly, and then I want to get into right up to the break. I want to talk about what's going on in the Democratic Party right now, just kind of briefly, too. But you kind of brought this up when we were putting the show notes together. What's going on with the Gothamists and DNA Info?
So the Gothamist and the DNA Info was bought by Joe Ricketts back in March, who is a co-owner of the Chicago Cubs. He's worth around $2.1 billion, and he's a huge Trump donor.
And we should say these are two online media sites, right?
Yeah. Yes, these are two online independent media sites that started back in the mid-2000s or 90s that served great local reporting, especially for Chicago, where DNA Info is from, and Gothamist is from New York City. And this, you know, last week, their employees, 115 of them, voted to form a union. And Ricketts decided to pull the plug on it, the whole thing. And not only did he shut down the websites because of this, he put out some bullshit statements saying this is not how a business venture is supposed to be. They're supposed to be profitable, making money, even though he's worth $2.1 billion. And, you know, you have many billionaires out there who sink money into their media establishments to keep them going out of benevolency. But he also got rid of their online archives. So any journalist who worked here for a number of years that's trying to get a job will now lose their archives, and it will make it that much harder for them to get hired somewhere else, because all of their records of their reporting that they would either use for jobs coming up is now has been destroyed, or at least thrown into the dustbin.
Yeah, it's crazy. You know, and this shows you that, you know, unadulterated power. You know, this is interesting. This reminds me of the, you know, what happened to Gawker. Right. I mean, you know, and, you know, people have love hate relationship to Gawker. Right. Because they would just kind of, you know, get into all sorts of celebrity gossip and crap like this. Right.
But, you know, now is the time more than ever we need an outlet like Gawker to exist.
Well, exactly. And Gawker was brought down by Peter Thiel. Right. I mean, Peter Thiel he got pissed off that Gawker, you know, some of the things that Gawker wrote about him, right? Because Gawker was really focused on part of it was, at least, what was happening in Silicon Valley. And we're reporting on kind of some of the choices that he made, and he did not like them. So when Hulk Hogan, when Gawker published a sex tape with Hulk Hogan, and Hulk Hogan decided to sue them, right? He was thrown out of court all over the place until they found this one court in Florida. And suddenly, Hulk Hogan had unlimited amounts of funds, right, to kind of to plead this case. And they made this crazy little move in that court case. There was a Netflix original movie this past summer on this. I'll bring up the title. I'll put it in there. But anyways, the point was is that it was found out, like, you know, near the end of the trial that Peter Thiel was actually funding the whole operation. Right. So they took away an aspect of the case. Right. They're basically Hulk Hogan was asking for damages. Right. Kind of emotional damages and things like this. But then the lawyers realized that if they took that away, then Gawker would no longer have a protection from their insurance company. So they just kind of went right after them. So it basically became every individual from the editor right down were kind of directly materially responsible for that lawsuit, and they just put them out of business. They ran them right out of business. This is no different, right? Except this is getting even more direct than that. You've got a person that's basically controlling these outlets and determining whether or not they stand or fall when employees decide that they want a better life. Not good, man. Not good. All the more reason, folks, become a member. RagingChickenPress.org, right? We can't depend on these people. So lastly, this week, Donna Brazile drops the, well, don't know if we call it a bomb. I called it a bomb, and I had some people. I said, look, he drops the bomb, and I had a couple people call me out. I was like, oh, come on. This was all reported on. I got it last year. And I'm like, yeah, okay, I'll give you that. Maybe bomb, dropping the bomb was not the right word. Maybe that's a little bit of oversell. But nonetheless, I think Donna Brazile coming out, there's an article in Politico. It's an excerpt from her forthcoming book, which is coming out on Tuesday. And she's basically going in and basically calling out what was happening inside the Democratic Party, why the Democratic Party was in just kind of like horrendous debt, and how basically the Hillary Clinton campaign came in and, you know, for all practical purposes, took over the and like materially paid for, right, the operations of the Democratic Party and how that kind of influenced what was going forward. So, I mean,
it also goes back to show that Obama really did nothing. Put an extremely incompetent person in Debbie Wasserman Schultz to lead the Democratic Party. And by the time the Clinton campaign took over, they were $24 million in debt.
Yep.
And really, this goes to question, is Thomas Perez going to be any better since he's an Obama candidate within that, since he's an Obama person within the current Democratic Party?
Yeah. And what was interesting, all indications are that, no, it's not going to change things. Right. Because one of the things that Donna Brazile writes in that was that, OK, look, the Democratic Party, normally what happens is that, you know, you have an election cycle. Obviously, you're going to be spending more money during an election cycle. But then in off year elections, you cut back on staff and all this other kind of stuff. But what the Democratic Party started doing is they started investing and spending tons of money on these kind of like private like consultants, right, outside and consultants, corporate consultants to do a lot of their work. And what happened after the like 2012 and 2008, after those elections, Wasserman Schultz did not shrink the personnel and continued to pay this whole consultant class, right? Very expensive consultant class until it basically, you know, helped to kind of bankrupt the party practically. And Brazile said that, look, everyone knew that she was not a good fundraiser, that she didn't tell people, didn't let other people know what was going on. She'd spring things on you at the last minute. And then suddenly, here you go, the party's in jeopardy. And it also shows a light on the fact that, you know, Brazile suggests that, you know, or other, I don't know if Brazile suggested, but other folks said, look, Obama didn't want any kind of other power base within the party. He wanted complete control over it. And he was perfectly happy with his consultants as a way of running the party.
Yep. And no, and this story also points out a lot of other things. It's really important. You know, it's one thing for like a Democrat to come out and say this, but I think, in my opinion, it's another thing for Donna Brazile to come out and say this.
Right.
Who, you know, is pretty much by all intents and purposes, she's been a hack for the Democratic Party for years now. And she came out and pretty much admitted, yes, this was rigged by the Clinton campaign. Not just because the DNC rigged it, but the DNC was being ran by the Clinton campaign going back into 2015. Like, it wasn't like this was something that happened during the primary. No, this was happening because the Clinton campaign was floating all this money to the DNC to bring it out of debt. So, of course, like, the DNC was going to support Clinton in all this. And one more shocking points is towards the end of it, mm-hmm. where, you know, Bernie could have just threw his hands up in the air and started shouting and screaming. When Sanders asked, you know, what she thought about this race, and Brazile was like, there's just no enthusiasm out there.
Yeah, he asked to kind of put the fine point on that, folks, is that she basically said, or Bernie asked her, said, well, what are you thinking about Clinton's chances?
And don't Brazile, trust the polls.
Right. And Brazile says, you know, I know all the polls are pointing this way, but I don't trust the polls. I've been out there on the ground and there is no enthusiasm. The enthusiasm is not there. Now, again, for the critics, yes, I get it. Yes, I know that some people were very enthusiastic for Hillary. There's no doubt about it. But when they were assessing things on the ground, they weren't seeing, you know, things like...
But also, to show you, she ran one of the worst campaigns in modern U.S. history.
Right. And I think that's the point that's got to be underscored here, is that what Donna Brazile says, look, why this is what I called was a bomb, right? She drops the bomb, is not because it changes what we already know about what happened, right? It's not like, you know, the smoking gun to prove that the system was rigged. We already knew that, right? The important thing here, for me at least, is that we're getting some more of the nitty gritty of the kind of that party apparatus that keeps the attention on why the Democratic Party needs to kind of like just get rid of this kind of like, you know, corporate Democratic center. And you bring up the point about Tom Perez being in there. We just saw last week, we talked about this on the show, about the purging of the Bernie-crats from the, the Bylaws and Rules Committee of the Democratic Party. Is like we're seeing basically the Democratic Party setting itself up for more losses, which is, you know, again, all the more reason that you just you dig in locally and you kind of build a power base, build a progressive power base right in our communities. Crazy. And I don't know if you saw this. Did you take a look at all at the autopsy, the Democratic Party autopsy?
No, I did not.
Well, maybe we'll talk a little bit more about this next week at some point where we can dig into it more specifically. But as you know, after the election, obviously one of the things that happens, not obviously, but what should happen after elections is that, especially when you take such a beating like this past election, and you bring someone like Trump right in there, you got to have to do a postmortem, right? You got to basically review what the hell, what did you do right, what went wrong, and doing this honestly as directly as possible. Whether or not the Democratic Party as a whole is kind of doing that, they're not really saying, but there's a group of folks that are have been Democrats, have been part of the committee structure, have been part of representatives and delegates and things like this. They dropped their first postmortem, and it was called the Democratic Party Autopsy. As written by kind of like Norman Solomon, I'm just forgetting the names of the people off the top of my head, but some people who've been involved with Democratic parties, the Democratic Party politics for a long time, and it's brutal. I'm telling you, it's a brutal and clear assessment about the alliance the Democratic Party has moved towards these kind of these corporate consultants and has gotten away from any kind of grassroots politics and is taking their own, people for granted. It's a really, really good read, an important read. And it's important that they put it out. And I thought the fact that it came out the same week that Donna Brazile's piece came out gives us a lot to chew on. Because Donna Brazile, as much as she's drawing attention to some of the problems that happened in the campaign, Donna Brazile has been, not a supporter of the progressive left in the party most of the time. So what's happening there in terms of political plays, I don't know. So I think it was important to have that strong voice coming from the progressive left of the party to come out the same week that Donna Brazile comes out. But we'll talk about that maybe a little bit more next week. But I don't know, Sean, you think there's any hope, man? You think they're going to get their act together? I don't.
I think they're going to get steamrolled in 2018.
Yep. Governor Wagner, folks. Governor Wagner.
I'm in a waste management business. Everybody immediately assumes you're mobbed up. It's a stereotype. And it's offensive.
You're next governor.
And Senator Barletta. Get used to those two words.
Well, on that wonderful, happy note, folks, we're going to come up to a break right now. We're going to take a quick break. We're going to come back and we're going to talk about what's going down here in Pennsylvania. I want to remind you, support this work. Become a member of Raging Chicken Press for as little as $5 a month. Go to ragingchickenpress.org, click on the support and membership tab, and you're on your way. We'll be back right after this.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1921. That was the day the New York Times headline proclaimed, "Striker rioting all over the city, dumped thousands of gallons of milk, Hyland threatens to seize plants." Hyland refers to New York City Mayor John Francis Hyland. Confrontations erupted between police and strikers, leading to multiple arrests. The striking milk drivers were angered because distributors had proposed cutting their wages as much as 20%. Milk, by the thousands of gallons, were taken from the trucks and stores and dumped into the streets. Non-striking drivers, as well as milk dealers, were stoned and beaten. Meanwhile, not letting a good crisis go to waste, storekeepers profited mightily from the strike, gouging consumers as much as 40 cents for a quart of milk, what at the time represented as much as a 300% increase. The New York Times article noted the health commissioner said that some complaints had been registered with his department and he would act if profiteering became a menace. By November 26th, it was reported that 80% of milk was back being delivered as the drivers' protests dwindled. The post-World War I period was a time of prosperity in the United States, but not for everyone. The wealthy did very well. Speakeasies flourished, making many gangsters and bootleggers prosperous. However, ordinary working people still had a hard life. There were many labor strikes during the 20s. Some of the most notable were the 1920 Matawan coal miners' strike in West Virginia, the 1928 Massachusetts textile strike, and the 1929 North Carolina textile mill strike. Sadly, the more things change, the more they remain the same. Today, we have a growing divide between the wealthy and the working class. Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.
Welcome back to Raging Chicken's Out to Coop podcast. And so, yeah, another great week. That first segment, I think, woof. I don't know what it is. And as Sean can tell you, if you kind of pull him aside, you run him to Harrisburg, you can tell, he will be the witness to the fact that I just can't get my act together today. So this is taking forever. Anyways, Sean, so you have some cool stuff coming out of Harrisburg this week, especially in light of all the, you know, continued revelations that, you know, about sexual harassment and kind of the conditions that women are facing in a variety of different workplaces. We saw this past week one of the heads of NPR, right, was also outed as kind of being a serial sexual harasser. And, you know, this is kind of, you know, it's one of these cascades, like, that is a necessary thing that we've got to kind of expose this stuff and to hopefully put an end to. So take us to this piece that, that you're talking about here from, Angela Columbus.
So, Angela is, she wrote an article for, the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, called, covering the PA Capitol while female. It's came after as a response to the Me Too movement. And, you know, it opens your eyes to how politicians treat females in the Capitol and also how they treat female reporters. She goes into detail about this. It's definitely worth reading. You know, it's some of the stuff is just, the stuff you see in the Capitol, the stuff you, you hear in the Capitol, the stuff you see in some of the bars downtown. You know, Harrisburg was known as Sodom and Gomorrah back in like the 1850s and 60s. And it's still like that today. You know, I've witnessed things in the Capitol. I've witnessed things in the bars downtown that are borderline sexual harassment, you know, sexual and sexual assault pretty much at that point, you know. And it's something that it's just not a Republican thing. It's both parties. It's both parties. It's lobbyists. It's everyone within this male dominant culture that's out here in Harrisburg. You know, one of the things that's going to have a lasting impact on what I witnessed firsthand. You know, I'll keep on telling the story over and over again. You know, standing outside of Planned Parenthood, hearing the Defund Planned Parenthood Senate hearing, where Senator Eichelberger just gets completely demolished by Democratic senators, gets embarrassed for not knowing what his bill does or the language in his bill or what other services Planned Parenthood provides. But, you know, we're standing outside talking to a couple of the Planned Parenthood folks, and Pennsylvania State Representative Dom Costa out of the Pittsburgh area walks by, and in a fat Albert voice goes, "Hey, hey, my ladies," and chuckles and says it to two female staffers outside as we're walking by, and it stopped me silent. Like, I heard it and I witnessed it. Like, you know, that's just it. It might have come off as a joke, but, you know, witnessing that and hearing that was extremely uncomfortable. Like, just because it's like something I would never consider saying to people, like, "Hey, hey, my ladies," in this like fat Albert type voice.
That's like, incredible.
It was a creepy, like, just hearing that and just seeing that uphand firsthand, you know, like you hear stories about it, but that was really the first time in the 2 years I've been out here that I saw someone that just out. I mean, that to me is like sexual misconduct. Like, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. You're demeaning people at that point, saying you're my ladies, you know, to two female staffers as they're walking by.
Well, yeah, and she, you know, again, this is, and that piece is a really good one. I think people definitely need to read it because, like, say for example, you know, when she tells a story that when she first was coming out to the reporting, she had a friend of hers that basically said, "Hey, it's like being back in high school," and she said that, you know, basically this past week, as you know, as female legislators and lobbyists and political consultants, all women who are basically, you know, from California, Illinois, and across the country, came forward to talk about the pervasive sexism and harassment in the state houses. She began thinking about what's happened in Pennsylvania because it was virtually silent coming up Pennsylvania. And so what some women were reporting from around the country, from state houses around the country, were something like this. This is from the from her words in the Post-Gazette. It says, quote, "What they describe should be unfathomable. A male legislator suggesting to a female colleague that performing sexual favors might help her push through legislative initiatives. A lobbyist being accosted in the restroom by a male legislator during a social gathering at a bar, only to discover that he had locked the door, exposed himself, and began masturbating." Like, things like this, right? This is the kind of thing that's happening behind the scenes. And then she goes on to talk about her own experience. And she says, you know, it was, quote, "it was still an era," those are what she talked about in the background, you know, about male power, blah, blah, blah. "So the first time a male legislator greeted me with a hug and a sloppy kiss on the cheek, I was speechless but not entirely surprised. I raced to the bathroom right after to wash it off with soap and water. And when another lawmaker whom I was interviewing in the Capitol hallway began casually stroking my arm as he spoke to me, I removed his hand but shrugged it off as just another example of that high school culture my colleague had warned me about. By the time a one-time legislative leader began relentlessly needling me over the phone that the reason my stories were tough was because I wasn't getting enough sex, and I had seen and heard enough just to let it roll off my back instead of giving him the satisfaction of reaction." Right? And then she kind of goes through these things. I mean, these are the kind of daily experiences that you can do. And I was always struck by that time, you know, in the Capitol, too, when that one that woman journalist who goes up to, I can't forget, the Eichelberger. Yeah. And he just basically says, "I'm done with you." Right? Just another example of this.
I know. I mean, like, you also had another female journalist get asked by a state senator, Scott Wagner, "How old are you? Why are you asking these questions?" Sort of like in a suggestive way, "You're just a kid. Shut up."
Right.
Like, you don't have any place here. You know, like, it's the type of thing where, you know, Angela is one of the best reporters in the Capitol by far. She is. If she doesn't have any Pulitzer Prizes, she definitely deserves to have some because of the work she does. You know, always breaking stories, always dropping bombs with the Philadelphia Inquirer. And now she's doing some reporting. I don't know what the details of that is, the partnership, but stuff's getting cross-posted over on the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. But, I mean, she's doing some of the best reporting. She's one of the best journalists in the Capitol, period.
Like, yeah, I remember.
Hands down. I mean, Mark Scrofolo, Mark Levy are really great with the AP, you know, but you have to follow the AP style guidelines. You have to, like, where she has a bit more freedom to do the reporting she can do. But I mean, the stuff she's been digging up the past 4 years, I mean, just the past decade almost, has been amazing work. And it's something to read this coming from her. It has a lot more weight to it.
Yeah.
Because of the work she's done over the past 10 years. And she's definitely like one of the people, I mean, she's like tiny, she's smaller than me, like height wise, but she's one of the most fiercest people in that room at any given time.
Well, I remember you talking about her after, you know, not long after you were in Harrisburg, is that you started kind of getting to know some of the, you know, Capitol reporters and so on. And you raved about her all the time, that she, how, like, what an amazing reporter that she was. The work that she was doing is fantastic. I mean, you were the first one that kind of drew my attention and said, "Hey, pay attention to this woman's work because she's one of the best reporters that's there."
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely something to look at, you know. It's some of the stuff I've witnessed firsthand to really open up my eye to it with, you know, a Democratic lawmaker. I mean, you also just had a state senator get caught, you know, rumored being caught having sex inside his Senate offices with a staffer. I mean, this is the type of stuff that goes on in the Capitol. It's not like it's, like, fake.
Mm-hmm.
This is the stuff that we hear all the time. You know, we don't report on it because it's, you know, it's a lot of rumors and stuff like that. But this is the exact type of stuff that goes on. You know, I shot off a thing, tweet on vacation over the summer that, you know, Democratic Party is holding back female leaders from making issues. And I got bombarded by a couple of high ranking Senate staffers and a couple of female legislators. But, you know, she explains in this article that when it comes to making policy decisions, the, like, actual budget decisions in the state, every single female legislator is left out of the room.
exactly. on this.
Yeah, like the Democrats might put females out there to do stuff, but she's left out of it. Why is Madeleine Dean not in leadership role?
Yeah, no kidding, man. She's amazing.
Like right now.
Yep.
You know, it's questions you have to ask.
No, absolutely that. So, I mean, you know, kudos there. And so you definitely got the link in our show notes today. Please go read that. It's really important because, you know, the more that, you know, you have constituents that are kind of demanding change, that's the only thing that's really going to matter until we make this an issue that's public and that we support, support the women who are doing this work. And number two, demand a change of that culture, right? No longer can we, because look, it's part of the same toxic kind of like, you know, hyper masculinity on all the kind of white privilege crap that goes along with that. It's all part of that same bag. The same reason that we've got the crap that we have and the kinds of policies that come out, the same thing that has kind of continues to be this kind of oppressive for women in everywhere. I mean, it's not just state capital, but these are our representatives, right? They're supposed to be accountable to us. So we have a role in demanding better, right? And demanding better, demanding that this stop and that we change that culture. And I don't give a shit if they're Republicans or Democrats, independents, doesn't matter, right? You know, the Democratic Party does not get a pass on this, not that it ever has, but no does even the most progressive folks. They need to step forward. You know, because I look at it like this, and this is the strength of this Me Too thing. When all the stuff came out about stuff about the, you know, the Catholic Church and the kind of pedophilia and the kind of abuse that was going on in the church. And people were saying, oh, good, there's whistleblowers and blah, blah, blah. I can't believe this is going on, blah, blah, blah. And the thing that got me more than anything else about that, then the acts themselves, right? The abuse itself, the brutality of it, like, obviously that's the worst. But what just I could never, ever get past, and this has been true in every other situation that I've been in, is that why on earth did no one say anything? Not the victims, but the priests, right? The people who have taken a vow, right, to basically represent God, right? Love, peace, like care, all this other kind of stuff, supposedly these moral things. Where the hell were they, right? Not just the bishops and the Pope, all that. Where were the priests every day speaking out against it? Because they knew, right? The same principle here. If this is going on every day in here and we know that, what are you going to do about it? You have to say something, right? You have to insist that it stops, right? And yes, it might be uncomfortable, right? And yes, it might kind of make you worry that is this going to affect you? Is you going to have this bad influence on your job, whatever like this? Maybe, but then you just got to step forward. And by you got to step forward, you know who knows about this mostly? Other guys, right? So it's on you guys, right? So kudos to that. Right there. Oh, boy. So, Sean, you had this other story this week, and we're going to talk about this in our members-only site a little bit more. We'll get into some of the fun aspects of this a little bit. But this is just kind of, you know, again, it's one of these little things that comes up, right? Just an Instagram-like picture, whatever. But, again, it's part of the same narrative that we've been kind of drawing attention to for a long time.
Yeah, so we're going to have like a little bit of a reading segment on our membership thing after this. You know, what I encountered on Facebook or Twitter on a tweet I put out there about this, you know, with some conservative group. But, you know, basically a Dickinson College student dressed up as Colin Kaepernick in blackface, had a wig on and had a Kaepernick jersey on. He was taking a knee and then there was a fake gun or a real gun pointed to his head. Most likely the gun was fake, but still you never point a gun to someone's head because, you know, it's basic rules of having a gun. A gun owner, but you know, and the post gets put up on Instagram, and you know, one of the things I'd say to people this week, thanks for anyone who submitted tips to us.
Oh yeah,
we had a bunch of tips come through this week. Shout out to them. Shout out to the person who sent this to me on Twitter. You know, it's someone who I know from the area. You know, and basically, you know, I think the best part of this was Pence. So, you know, we put this up there, did some reporting. You know, everyone knows Colin Kaepernick is responsible for the Take a Knee protest against police brutality, which has morphed into a cause celeb for the right wing, basically saying you're disrespecting our flag when it's not the intention of the protest. And, you know, Penn Live initially put out a headline without mentioning Colin Kaepernick's name in it, without mentioning anything in it. The student was dressed as a black person.
In other news.
Like random. Yeah, he's just dressed by as a black person, happens to be wearing a 49ers jersey with number 7 on it. I wonder who it could be. It could be like Joe Montana. What about Steve Young? I don't know.
No, yeah. I mean, how you miss that in this context too is really hard to fathom. You know, I mean, given the fact that it's, you know, everywhere in the national news, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, something else. And, you know, you just got to shake your head at this stuff sometimes.
We're going to talk more about this later. I had with a troll editor from this, like, college newspaper.
The trolls!
And basically trying to discredit my reporting over a stupid word I said. So please listen to this afterwards, and we'll get right into that.
Yeah, because as part of that, too, we'll have a little some of the tips to kind of watch out for about how these people behave and kind of what they try to do and how they try to undermine you. So. We'll look at that. So cool. But some big news. This was like I actually before I shared this, I went and kind of like I read this article and then I went through it again to make sure that it wasn't just like, you know, like a fake story that was being put forward to see if he would share it. Because I just couldn't believe it. I'm like, what era am I living in? I mean, how is this actually happening?
Seizing the means of productions, man.
Exactly. I'm like, what is going on? So the story is about Philadelphia Mayor Jim Kenney basically announcing that the city is going to seize control of the public school system. I'm like, you're nationalizing stuff like that. I'm like, oh my God, Philadelphia's Cuba. What's going on?
Jez is coming to Philly.
Right, exactly. But, you know, this is, I mean, I don't know. What we're going to have to see what the details are on this as this kind of moves forward, what they're actually talking about. But the fact that you're saying that the city is going to seize control away from the School Reform Commission, that statewide body, right, which has kind of been pro-charterization and privatization, to seize control over it and pay for it is something else. So, I mean, I don't know, Sean. I mean, this blew my mind this week.
So the Philadelphia, Philly.com story we have linked to, if you hit your paywall, just hit the right click, go to incognito tab, and you'll be able to read the story there. With this, I definitely recommend reading it. Basically, it says on November 16th, the 5-member School Reform Commission, SRC, will consider a vote to dissolve itself, which it has to be a unanimous vote. It has to be a 5-0 vote to do this. And Kenny is confident that it will be approved. The state secretary of education would certify the dissolution by December 31st, a move that seems a given with Governor Wolf on record supporting local control of Philadelphia schools. The SRC would cease to exist on June 30th. And then that means it would go right into the hands of the Philadelphia School District on July 1st, beginning of the fiscal year. It would be replaced by a 9-member school board appointed by Kenny. Those members will serve terms concurrent with the mayor's.
Unbelievable. That's unbelievable.
I mean, this is something activists have been fighting with Wolf about for a while. This is something activists have been fighting with Kenny for a while. And it's a campaign promise that both of them are coming through on.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is something else. This could potentially be super, super significant. And like I say, I mean, I want to dig into some of the details, and we just got to keep an eye on this as this moves forward. Because this, if it is what it seems like, this could very well set a precedent and kind of offer a model for how we actually begin to think about pushing back against the forces of privatization and education. I mean, I kudos to Kenny for getting this ball rolling.
I mean, this is a big deal. Yeah, this is something to definitely keep an eye on.
So I just got to ask this question, and just because this is my skeptical self and things like this, how much of this do you think this is about politics, right, in terms of kind of moving into a 2018 electoral season, and how much of it is actually about an actual commitment?
You know, that's a good question. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not going to be an election year for Kenny, that he's not going to be up for a couple more years now.
Yep.
But on Wolf's end, yes, this is about education. But, I mean, the Republicans have neglected education funding in this state and have hampered Philadelphia in doing this. It's going to be interesting to see where this goes.
Indeed. So we're going to keep on following this because it's something else. So right before we take a break, so we're not going to go drag on forever for this segment. We're going to try to do our best to stay within, get out. Well, it's afternoon already, but that's my fault. Here we go. But I do want to give a shout out for next Friday, November 10th, kicks off March on Harrisburg 2.0. Now, remember, we covered this, the March on Harrisburg. Sean had some amazing video from that, from the first March on Harrisburg that left from Philadelphia, that marched all the way 100-plus miles to Harrisburg, and to kind of advocate for these three bills, right, these three these policies that basically would end gerrymandering in the state, would ban unlimited gifts to state legislators, because currently that's allowed, and to create an automatic voter registration system, right? So what's so important about this, and I think this, you know, why we've been following this, why we continue to kind of stay in touch with the people that are doing this, organizing these events, because they're not just saying, get the money out of politics, right? And arguing for that. That's important, of course. But what they've got, they've been pushing really hard, and they work nonstop around the year, right, to be out there lobbying in Harrisburg for these three bills. And they use these marches as a way of kind of bringing people from different aspects of the state, and again, to keep the pressure on to get the money out of politics and to end partisan gerrymandering. It's something else, Sean. And, you know, so they're going to be leaving Lancaster. They're marching from Lancaster. It's a 36-mile... Lancaster, whatever. Lancaster. I can't do it. Yeah, you still say Wooder, too, but, you know, I don't give you a hard time about that all the time. So they leave on Friday, November 10th, and they're going to be arriving in Harrisburg, I think, on the 13th? 13th, yes. 14th?
Yes, and there's going to be actions on the 13th and 14th, and more arrests happening. And it's definitely going to be fun watching this. These are a great group of people. They've been out here for a while, and maybe we should try to get them on the podcast sometime to talk about this.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I was thinking about this too. You know, we know we've talked about Reed before. We've talked about some of these other folks. I would love to have as one of our future members only things. We've got to do one of these, kind of roundtables where we're just kind of getting folks on who are active in the movements and kind of talk about some of the issues of the day. Talk about questions of strategy. What's going on in the background? Just as some kind of, you know, the kind of discussions I think we need to have, right, in that kind of smaller group session. So we'll see. So keep that out.
And then there is word that the 20-week abortion ban may be making its way through the legislature again in December.
Really?
And as people know, the session does not end December 31st because it's not a odd year. It's not because it's a even year election year. That'll be next year, next December, following December, when the session ends. But activists, female activists, women activists in the region are starting to get their costumes going. So there's already chatter within some of the local Indivisible groups out here in central Pennsylvania and some of the fierce women's networks out here in central Pennsylvania that women are getting their Handmaid's Tale costumes ready for any potential vote on the 20-week abortion ban coming up or any potential hearing on this.
Awesome. Is there any indication what time frame we're looking at?
Possibly in December. That's what they're thinking.
All right. We'll put some links up to this, and we'll come back, maybe talk a little bit more about it next week, especially if we can get in touch with some folks that are actually doing some of that organizing before next week's show. All right. This is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. One more reminder, become a member if you can. RagingChickenPress.org, support membership tab. All right, we'll be back right after this break with our last call. This is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. Over the past 6 years, we've brought unapologetic, progressive, activist media to Pennsylvania and beyond. We've helped hold those in power accountable and shine a light on some amazing activist work. We've broken national stories and established a reputation as an aggressive, independent media site. As newsrooms close and traditional journalists lose their jobs, hard-hitting investigative news suffers. If we care about our democracy, we have to find new, sustainable models of journalism. And frankly, no one's going to do it for us. After the Trump election, we dug in even deeper. Thanks to some longtime members, one-time donations, and a shift in other resources, we brought on more writers and started paying them. Now we're doubling down and want to expand our infrastructure and pay our writers even more. We need to invest in our media if we have a chance to resist the unprecedented assault on democracy, working families, women's rights, and our planet. History will remember the choices we make today. So take a minute to become a member of Raging Chicken Press. For as little as $5 a month, the price of a local craft beer or a cup of coffee, you will be supporting homegrown progressive journalists and media activists. Go to RagingChickenPress.org and click on the Support and Membership tab to become a member. Leave a one-time donation or learn about other ways that you can help. We don't have billionaire backers. Keeping progressive activist media going strong depends on you. Thank you for all your help and support. Keep up the fight. Welcome back to Raging Chicken's Out the Coop podcast. It's time for our last call. And we're having a kind of tough, especially a tough time today because, man, there's a guy, he's sitting at the bar and he's got a vape, he's got a little vape box and I can't stand the vape. It's getting my face, it's ruining my experience. That was Sean at the bar the other night. Having a run-in with his vaping
fucking
friend.
Douchebag with a vape box sitting like a few seats next to me at the bar, and the way it's like set up, okay, he's like, this is a non-smoking bar, okay, you know, he's, you know, I'm sitting in the corner of the bar, and then you can go up like next couple seats are above you, and he's just like hitting on this vape box, blowing it over towards me, and I'm talking to him, having a couple of beers with friends, and I'm just like, fucking asshole's the worst.
I can't stand it. I'm just trying to hear you have a beer, man. We're talking to my friends, and I'm smelling like freaking cloves and frankincense, man. It's like Christmas over here. I can't stand it, man. Get your vape box out of here. That's what Sean was writing on Twitter.
Facebook. So I put up on Facebook, and one of my friends who's sitting at the other end of the bar chimes in the conversation later on in the night. It's like, oh, I guess you're talking about the dude at the Midtown. I'm like, yeah, that guy's a fucking asshole, dude. I don't like vape bros. Oh, God.
Vape bros.
I mean, like, yeah, sometimes I have a pen, a small pen, doesn't have nicotine in it.
Frankincense. It's got some cloves.
Yes.
Some orange peel.
An herb.
It's got some tea leaves in there. Yeah. I like to have it just a little bit. It gives me a little bit of pick me up, you know.
So I might be guilty of this sometimes.
It gets me like a little relaxing. You know, it's not really, dude, it's not like about, you just got to know the ethics of it, bro, right? You just got to have like, you got a little puff smoke come out of your mouth, man. It's just fine. You know, it's a little vape, but come in here with this little freaking vape box,
had,
man. It's
like a box. He had like a trail of smoke. That
fucking
went, like,
buzzkill, man. He's fucking buzzkill all that freaking shit coming out that box. Just come on over here, man. I'll show you what to do.
But I was getting to the point where I just felt like getting up, I had a few beers in me, and just telling them that, like, dude, what's your problem?
Dude, what's your problem with this vape box, man? What are you getting to do? I can't take it anymore with your fucking box.
Well, what do you think about that? Come on now, if you're sitting at the bar speaking seriously and some dude's vaping in your face, you don't get mad at that?
Yeah, no, I do. Totally. I always think it was just the funniest thing for me. It was like when I saw, like, you start posting this stuff on it, right? I could tell, like, you know, you're just like ready to explode. And I could see it. No, man, it's crazy.
It was like 20 or 30 minutes of him just vaping. I'm just like, Jesus Christ.
Yeah, that was like, and so vaping, then you can vape, and that's not considered smoking in a building then, I guess.
I guess so, but I think it's up to the discretion of the bar. It's a non-smoking bar.
Yeah, I'll tell you, I remember when they started passing the laws that banned smoking in bars, right? And, you know, people all got all wang about it, but holy crap. It was so awesome. I mean, I lived in Allentown when they were Bandit in Pennsylvania, and there used to be this bar right down the street from where I lived. And I used to go there just, you know, for dinner and things like this. And, you know, it's kind of just to get out of the freaking house, especially when I didn't know anybody in Allentown yet. So I'd go over there, and it was so smoky. I would come in, I would be reeking from it, coughing, all this kind of stuff. And then, like, a year later, when they passed that law, you'd go in there and, like, oh my God, this is amazing.
I know. It's the type of thing where, like, you know, like, people were, I remember that I was a kid, and people were always complaining about that, especially people in my family who smoke. But, like, dude, I have the right to that clean air. Like, you know, like, it's like, that right to Mike to clean that to that clean air, and you know, because you want to give me the detriment health side effects because if you're smoking at the bar, fuck you.
No, and I just looked at it like this: is like, okay, look, you smoke,
it's also
you smoke.
Like a workplace issue too for employees.
Right, exactly.
Like,
no, it's like, look, you smoke. I mean, that's your call. I mean, you obviously know the health, you know. You know the health effects of it, and you know, again, stopping smoking is not easy. Right. So it's not like saying, oh, you're just choosing to do the bad thing. But again, it's about what we want our environments to be, right? And we know that secondhand smoke has really detrimental health effects, and that's what it comes down to. It just kind of reinforces that, and it actually has, I've known some people who it actually has helped them quit because, instead of kind of sitting there, you go out and you're having, some beers with friends and stuff. And then instead of kind of like going out, going outside and kind of having to smoke outside, you just kind of just sit around and hang out with friends. Cause it was always like in those situations that they'd be more likely to kind of, break their commitment to quit smoking and stuff. So, yeah. But now there's vaping, man. That was fun, man. I loved seeing that when I saw it come up. So anyways, so this week we got some cool releases. Walk us through the Pizza Boys.
Well, as Pizza Boy, the juice is loose.
The juice is loose.
They released a milk sugar orange juice IPA called the White Bronco. Totally no OJ reference there.
Got that? And that's why I'm like, are you everybody? Just pause for a minute. Just take that in.
There's other OJ beers that have come out. OJ Simcoe, an orange juice Simcoe IPA, some other people. So people are having fun with this.
Yes.
In the brewing community. We're not just the only one, hopping on it. But it's a really good beer. And then Monday, they're releasing a New England-style IPA called Doughboy. It's going to be coming at 5.7%.
Nice. Very cool. Very, very cool. We had this week, same thing out here, big release week for at Free Will, down my neck of the woods. This came out in four packs. There was it's called Love Letter from the 90s. It's an Imperial India Cream Ale, right, which comes in at 7%. It was in the 16-ounce cans once again. And they limited it on one case per person. And, I don't know. I didn't catch this. Both of these were actually released on Halloween. They were going there for a while where all the releases were coming out on a Thursday. And so I start paying attention there, but now they're doing Tuesday. So I'm hoping there's still some left because I'm going to head over there after, later on today, just to hopefully kind of pick up a couple of those. So that was the Love Letter IPA. And this is how they describe it. It's an Imperial Cream Ale brewed with oats, milk sugar, and Bloody Butcher corn from the Castle Valley Mill in Doylestown. Which is cool. Like they're again supporting local ingredients and so on. And then a triple dry hopped with Galaxy, Mosaic, and Citra, creating a juicy, fruity, totally red, hazy hop bomb. So we'll see how that is. And it does have notes of tangerine just to kind of, link up with that OJ thing you got going there. So the other one, it's called Special Cookie. It's an Imperial Spice Brown Ale that comes in at 12.5, right? So it's a heavy beer, heavy on the alcohol thing. Also there in four packs. And I had a pre-taste of it. It's kind of interesting beer. It wasn't what I was expecting when I first had it, but it's kind of cool. And they said, they have this one beer. It's called the Speculoos Cookies, right? And this is kind of a riff on that, a riff on the Speculoos Cookies. And so it's got like this cardamom, brown sugary, cinnamon, ginger, like these fall spices in there, some vanilla and that kind of thing. So it makes for an interesting kind of fall beer, right? So I got to pick up some of that too as well and kind of check that out. So, and Free Will this weekend, if you're not doing anything, once again, they'll have the food trucks going crazy out there all weekend, bringing in November right. I think they've got the Egyptian one again this week, if I remember correctly. I can't remember. Let me see if I can find it real quick. Yeah, so here you've got... Yeah, so actually, that was yesterday was the Egyptian cuisine. Tonight, this is Friday, you got Urban Wood Fire Pizza. And actually, my family and I got that a couple weeks back. This stuff is awesome. And then on Saturday, they got this Trey locally sourced place. And they're also going to be joining in the Apple Festival up in Peddler's Village and so on like that. So pretty cool stuff. Another thing they're doing, actually, there's the Hot Rods and Hops 2017. This is down at Neshaminy Creek Brewing Company from 12 to 5 on Saturday, if anybody's looking for something to do tomorrow. Then Sunday back at Free Will with the Flying Pie Guy, and beer, of course. So that's my rundown, at least for what's going on, kind of this neck of the woods for that.
And one last thing, I guess, before we, say goodbye for the week.
Yeah.
Frank Rizzo statue in Philadelphia.
It's coming down.
Well, it's being moved to a different location.
Oh,
so, social justice warriors and, snowflake liberals have won.
Ryan Grizzly, what do you mean? Where am I going? Where am I going? Fuck you. What are you doing to my statue? So,
how about that? Philadelphia's hometown racist.
Being moved away from the municipal services building in Philadelphia.
Doesn't say where it's going?
No. I hope it gets like melted down for steel and bullets and stuff like that, or maybe like, you know, like.
And bullets? What the hell are you saying?
Not bullets. Smelted down for,
I hope,
like,
it gets melted down for steel and bullets.
I was thinking of like, the hell is that? Back in the revolutionary days. They would melt it down. Like they would for like their musket balls. There we go.
How about swords into plowshares? How don't we go in that direction? I hope they melt down Frank Rizzo and they make daggers out of it. Swords or like maybe like morning stars and maces.
All right, I didn't mean like that. I was not paying attention. I like musket balls.
Honestly, you're still caught in that cloud from the vape, dude, man. Oh man, it's been quite a day. All right, so Sean, anything else for the good of the order today?
No, please tune in, listen to our nice little fun extended segment by becoming a member.
Yes, by becoming a member. And again, once again, to close out today, special shout out once again to Melissa, Astrid, Randall, and Steve for becoming members this week, right, and putting us up over the top. Because now November will be the first time that we're able to kind of kick in our kind of next level of compensation for our writers. So this is a big deal. Thanks, everybody. Once again, this is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. We will be back to you once again next week with another edition of Out the Coop. In the meantime, check out our things out. Oh, probably going to have some cool interviews coming up next week, too, as well. So keep posted. All right. We're out of here. See ya.